From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, what the influenza pandemic of 1918 can tell us about today's pandemic. We talk with John Barry, whose 2004 book about the 1918 pandemic is a current bestseller. He co-wrote a report about the future of the COVID-19 pandemic and lessons learned from the pandemic influenza that was published by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Also, we remember an eccentric figure in the world of pop music, Ian Whitcomb. He died last month of complications from a stroke. He had the 1965 novelty hit, You Turn Me On, but soon after, devoted himself to writing books about early American popular song and to performing those songs. Later, Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings of music by Bach and Handel.
Support for this podcast comes from the Neubauer Family Foundation, supporting WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation.
Back in 2004, when I interviewed the author of the book, The Great Influenza, about the 1918 influenza pandemic, the deadliest pandemic in history, I thought, this is fascinating history. Thank goodness I'm not living through anything like this. And now, here I am, and here you are, our lives having been changed by the COVID-19 pandemic. And there's that 2004 book on today's bestseller list. And here's the author, my guest, John Barry. He's going to tell us about some of the successful strategies and mistakes from 1918 that might give us some clues for how to proceed in this current pandemic. Barry co-wrote the paper about the future of the COVID-19 pandemic and lessons learned from pandemic influenza that was published April 30th by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's a professor at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. John Barry, welcome back to Fresh Air. Did you expect when you wrote the book that you would witness a pandemic like the one we're enduring now?
Yes and no. I think anybody who understands anything about infectious disease recognized that we were going to, sooner or later, face something like this. Obviously, in the last 15, 20 years, you had H5N1, SARS, MERS, H7N9, Ebola. But you know, intellectually understanding it is one thing, and having it hit you is something quite different. So I'm like everyone else in that sense.
President Trump called the coronavirus the Democrats' new hoax early in the pandemic. That was a reference to a new hoax after the impeachment hoax. Now the virus is in the White House. One of the problems in 1918 was political denial. Give us an example of the political denial from 1918 and how that made matters worse.
Well, we were at war, and Woodrow Wilson, the president, was entirely focused on the war, entirely. And the entire government was entirely focused on the war. And therefore, national public health leaders echoed the president, and they ignored it. They said the disease was called Spanish influenza. And they said things like, quote, this is ordinary influenza with another name, unquote, or you have nothing to worry about if proper precautions are taken. There was no Tony Fauci back then. Around the country, local public health officials almost entirely echoed that, and so did local politicians. So the result was people were being lied to, and frankly, people died unnecessarily.
How did the denial lead to more death?
Well, there was, until it became extremely obvious how dangerous that disease was, people did not take any precautions because of the reassurances. And also, once they recognized that they were being lied to, that this disease was violent and lethal, it led to almost a fraying of society in some places. I think that society ultimately is based on trust. And once trust disintegrated, society began to fray. That disease was much, much more lethal than what we are facing now.
How lethal was it? What was the casualty count?
Well, worldwide, the deaths were probably at least 50 million and may have reached 100 million. So if you adjust for population, that would equal about 220 million to 440 million deaths today. Thankfully, we're not facing anything like that with COVID-19. Thank God.
One of the things that we're facing now is figuring out how to reopen cities and states and restart the economy. People are suffering not just from the virus, but from unemployment, and they need money, they need food. And the question is, how do you do it? How do you do it without increasing the number of people who are sick and dying from COVID-19? So what can we learn from 1918 about what happens if you reopen too soon?
Well, a lot of cities did reopen too soon and had to close down a second time, and in some cases, a third time. I think San Antonio would be a good example of what happened back then. They were just about the last city to close down and just about the very first to open back up. And in San Antonio, 53.5% of the entire population got sick. 98% of the homes had at least one person sick.
Do you think we're starting to see something similar in places that were reasonably successful in shutting down the virus? I'm thinking of Singapore, South Korea, Wuhan, China. They're starting to see new cases again after reopening.
Well, you know, no matter how careful you are, when you reopen, there are going to be cases. The disease, the virus is out there. The question is how careful you are going to be when you reopen, how much control you're able to maintain over the virus. And Singapore is sort of a special case. They had dormitories where foreign workers were lodged, and the overwhelming majority of new cases are in those dormitories, you know, close quarters and so forth, as opposed to the general population. In China, the overwhelming majority of cases, at least initially, the new cases, they were people returning from abroad. But to actually exterminate this virus, you know, maybe it could have been possible in the very, very first days. And I mean very first days. But that was before it was really recognized. And it's not possible to do that today. The virus is here. It's going to stick around unless we are fortunate enough to get a vaccine that's essentially 100% effective. Even then, it would take years to exterminate it. There's only one disease that has ever happened with, smallpox. We came close in polio, but haven't been able to do it in polio. This disease is much more transmissible. It's just too transmissible to exterminate. Plus, it has an animal reservoir. So even if we were able to eliminate it from humans, it would circulate in animals and eventually probably come back.
The 1918 flu pandemic coincided with World War I. How much of the initial spread was through soldiers in tight quarters and then traveling overseas and back?
Well, you know, the certainly was spread among soldiers. And it seemed that the shipment of U.S. troops in April spread the disease in Europe. I think that's clear. But all these things would have happened anyway. For example, the disease was in New York City in February 1918 and spreading there. That was actually before any army camp was infected. The disease may have been elsewhere in the world as well, probably, almost certainly was elsewhere in the world as well. So the results would have been the same. They may have moved a little bit more slowly. So I don't think the war played a major role in spreading the disease, just accelerated a few weeks, perhaps.
How did the Army try to control the outbreaks in its own camps?
They were quite aggressive, actually, initially. The best scientists and physicians in the country were in the Army. The dean of the Johns Hopkins Medical School, a guy named William Welch, became a colonel. He's probably easily the most important person in the history of American medicine and maybe the most important person in the history of American science. The Army Surgeon General, William Gorgas, was a terrific physician, a terrific public health person, knew what was going on. They had sort of anticipated something like this. In practically every war in history in the past, more soldiers had died from disease than from combat. And Gorgas was determined that that would not happen this time. They did everything from outfitting railroad cars, transforming them into the most advanced laboratories. They had, you know, great scientists, the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, which is now Rockefeller University, that was incorporated entirely into the Army. Every scientist there became a soldier. And when the disease first erupted, you know, they tried to close down the camps, separate them from civilian communities and so forth, and keep the disease from getting into the camps. And some of them were quite aggressive, but none of these things were successful. And I mean, some camps, they wouldn't inspect soldiers twice a day for symptoms. If one soldier was showed a symptom, he was isolated. If two soldiers in a unit showed symptoms, the entire unit would be quarantined. So many of the camps were very aggressive. Nonetheless, they had very little impact on the disease.
So how did the pandemic affect the war effort? You know, you write about in your book how to keep up morale. You were supposed to say positive things, and there was a lot of censorship. But we'll get to that in a minute. But one of the ways the pandemic affected the war effort was the draft was eventually canceled. How was that connected to the pandemic?
Well, the Army camps, and that was on September 26, 1918. Incidentally, nobody realized how close the war was to ending. There was an anticipation that the Allied forces would have to launch a major offensive in the spring of 1919 to end the war. But on September 26, Army camps around the country were so totally overwhelmed with disease that they didn't want anybody else entering those camps. Plus, they were afraid in the few camps that might not have been affected already, that someone from outside might bring the disease in. So they canceled the draft. You know, that was one way the war effort was affected.
You know, you write about how in 1918, were there bodies in the street? You write the bodies were literally piling up.
That's correct.
And, in the street? At homes?
You know, they were digging mass graves. They were, you know, had no place to store them. You know, they, you know, varied, of course, from city to city and army camp to army camp. You know, there were, in a lot of the army bases, there were actually special trains to carry away dead bodies. In you know, Philadelphia, they were using construction equipment to dig mass graves. And also in Philadelphia, you literally had priests driving horse-drawn carts through the streets, calling upon people to bring out their dead, because there was no other way to get the bodies out of the homes. You know, sometimes a body would lie in a home in 1918 for several days. Not exactly the kind of experience anybody would enjoy.
No, actually, when President Woodrow Wilson was negotiating the end of the war in Paris, he came down with the virus.
Right. And I think it affected what happened in a very deleterious way.
What happened in the peace plan or what happened to Wilson or both?
Both. Wilson was quite sick. Classic case of the 1918 virus, very high fever, violent coughing, so violent that he had difficulty breathing. other symptoms as well. But a comprehensive look written in 1927 by sponsored by the American Medical Association of, you know, everything that that virus did. Anyway, it concluded that second only to pulmonary damage, the virus seemed to affect mental functioning. And that happened to Wilson. Everybody around him commented on how disoriented he was, how his mind just wasn't working. Anyway, prior to getting sick, Wilson was adamant on, you know, the U.S. had ended the war on his 14 points. You know, these are principled positions that he took about self-determination for, and, you know, anti-colonial and the League of Nations and so forth. Peace without victory, you know, don't blame anybody, things like that. And he had been sticking to those points. And he re-entered negotiations while he was still sick. In fact, some of them came in his sick bed. Anyway, after his illness, Wilson caved in on basically every point except for the League of Nations. And the result was a peace treaty that was not very satisfactory. You know, the reparations, the Germans, you know, the Germans lost territory to France. They paid reparations, all sorts of things that, you know, I think most historians believe that the peace treaty was a major contributor to the rise of Hitler and the eruption of World War II.
President Wilson never publicly addressed the pandemic. Why not?
You know, it's a good question. I don't really have an answer other than his personality. He was so focused on the war. That was everything to him. And he would not allow anything to distract him. And he tried not to allow anything to distract the country. You know, I never saw any papers, private or otherwise, explaining why he didn't. It makes no sense, but it's a true statement.
So the flu pandemic of 1918 coincided with World War One, and there were policies to prevent anything that would lower morale, including the Sedition Act, which made it punishable by 20 years in jail to, quote, utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government of the U.S. And you could go to jail for cursing the government or criticizing it, even if what you said was true. So how did this emphasis on saying positive things, keeping up morale, and not saying anything negative about the government or anything that would lower morale, how did that affect information, helpful, useful, important information about the pandemic and how it was spreading and what you needed to do to protect yourself?
Well, there was fake news in 1918, but it was coming from the government, and it was being echoed by newspapers around the country. You know, consistent with that law that you just quoted. That's why almost everywhere in the country, not quite everywhere, public health leaders locally and local politicians were saying this is nothing to worry about, but it was something to worry about. It got so bad in Philadelphia when they finally, belatedly, you know, issued their closing orders. You know, closed schools, churches, no church services, you know, bars, restaurants, so forth and so on, theaters. One of the newspapers said, quote, this is not a public health measure. You have no cause for panic or alarm, unquote. You know, I mean, how stupid did they think people were? Obviously, yeah, I mean, but that was an attempt to reassure by saying these closings are not public health measures, but of course they were. And of course people knew that. And the only effect a statement like that had was that people stopped believing anything they were being told. And that meant that rumor and bad information was dominant. Nobody knew what was going on And when they're getting no information, when they're being told this is ordinary influenza by another name, and these things are happening, or in some cases, people are dying 24 hours after the first symptoms, all that did was spread fear, and in some cases, panic.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Barry. His 2004 book, The Great Influenza, about the flu pandemic of 1918, is on the current bestseller list. We'll talk more about 1918 and today's pandemic after we take a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With Capital One, you can earn 5 times the national average savings rate, so you can save confidently knowing that your money is growing in a safe place every day. Capital One is helping you earn more towards your savings goals. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
Let's get back to my interview with John Barry. His 2004 book, The Great Influenza, about the 1918 flu pandemic, the deadliest pandemic in history, is on the current bestseller list. He co-wrote a paper about the future of the COVID-19 pandemic and lessons learned from pandemic influenza, which was published last month by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Barry is a professor at the Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. What about the newspapers? Were they accurately reporting what was going on?
They were, as a general rule, not. In fact, early in the pandemic, when one Wisconsin newspaper actually tried to report the truth, the Army initiated prosecution proceedings under the law you quoted.
The Sedition Act?
Correct. So they were going to try to put those editors and writers in jail. They dropped the prosecution as the pandemic proceeded. But again, all around the country, in most cases, newspapers were not printing the truth. In Phoenix, it was funny. Normally, local news predominates. But in Phoenix, when the disease first hit Boston, which was the first place in the country that was hit by the second wave, the lethal wave, you could read about it a little bit in Phoenix. But when the disease actually got to Phoenix, there was hardly a word about it anywhere in the newspapers. At least they weren't lying, but they weren't printing anything about it because they thought that would be bad for the war effort, bad for morale. And again, the only effect of that was to spread fear because people did not know and they need to know.
A famous example of something that was done wrong during the 1918 pandemic that we've heard a lot of references to recently is what happened in Philadelphia when it decided to have a war bond drive and not call it off in the face of the pandemic. And I want you to describe that war bond drive. And this, of course, was to raise money for the war effort. So what was that? This was basically a parade that stretched for like 2 miles. Describe what you know about that.
Well, it was heavily promoted. Philadelphians were supposed to demonstrate their patriotism by coming out, by supporting the war effort, buying Liberty loans, bonds. And, you know, it was going to be one of the great events in the city's history. The medical community, to a person, urged the public health commissioner and the mayor to cancel the parade. That didn't happen. Several hundred thousand people turned out. And, I mean, by then the virus was already circulating pretty widely in the community. And like clockwork, 48, 72 hours later, after the parade, the disease just exploded in Philadelphia. And it was, you know, sort of a classic example, as you said, of what not to do.
Did you think about the Philadelphia example when New Orleans held its Mardi Gras parade just a few weeks ago?
I didn't. You know, as I mentioned earlier, in January, I actually wrote a piece for the Washington Post saying, you know, this arguing, making the point really that the virus could not be contained, that it was going to get here and it was going to be pretty serious. But at the time of Mardi Gras, I don't think there had even been a single death at the time known. Now we know there had been deaths But at the time, there was not a single known death, I don't think. And, you know, no cases known, although now we know there had been in Louisiana, very little testing anywhere in the United States. And it didn't seem dangerous to me then because although I anticipated that the virus would get to the United States and that it would be quite severe, I didn't think it had arrived yet based on the information I was getting on testing. Obviously, on that point, I was wrong. I live in the French Quarter. I was even king of Crew de Vue, one of a satiric crew, a few years ago, but I actually am not a parade person, fortunately, and I usually go to one parade a year at least, but I didn't go to any this year, fortunately, because it clearly did spread the virus.
Do you feel very frustrated and worried watching us fall, like making some of the same mistakes that were made in 1918?
Yes, there's a short answer.
What are some of the major mistakes you think we are repeating or we have repeated?
Well, first, for very different reasons, the outbreak was trivialized for a long time. And if these public health measures, social distancing and so forth, are going to be successful, people have to comply with the recommendations. So by trivializing the threat for a period of months, that sort of encourages people to ignore recommendations, gets it implanted in people's minds that this is not a real threat and that it's being overblown by the media. You know, that's number one. Number two, the testing debacle, which continues, unfortunately, is just a huge, huge problem. When places come out of lockdown, they really should have the testing and the contact tracing in place. These things work. They have been demonstrated to be highly successful in saving lives and also allowing the economy to function in many countries around the world. I won't say we are dead last. We're not dead last. There are plenty of other countries worse off than we are on a policy and execution basis. But for a country that should be the best in the world to be where we are in these areas is almost beyond belief.
John Barry, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air. Be well, be safe.
And same to you.
Thank you so much. John Barry is the author of the 2004 book, The Great Influenza, about the 1918 pandemic. It's on the current bestseller list. He's a professor at the Tulane University School of Public Health. After we take a short break, we'll listen back to an interview with Ian Whitcomb, who had the 1965 novelty hit You Turn Me On, and left the rock world soon after to perform and write about pop music of the early 20th century. This is Fresh Air.
Face masks have become the new normal as we continue to grapple with the ongoing pandemic. But when did we start wearing masks for our health and safety?
This week on Throughline, the origins of the N95 mask and how it became the life-saving tool it is today.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
We're going to remember Ian Whitcomb, an eccentric figure in the world of pop music. He died last month in Pasadena from complications of a stroke. He was 78. Many people knew him for his 1965 novelty record, You Turn Me On, which was a top 10 hit. But after a brief career in rock music, he turned to the music he loved most, early American popular song. He wrote books about those songs, covering the years from the early 20th century to the dawn of rock and roll, including After the Ball, Pop Music from Rag to Rock, published in 1972, and Irving Berlin and Ragtime America, whose publication was the occasion for my interview with him in 1988, which we're about to hear. Let's start with his recording of an obscure Irving Berlin song, When the Folks High Up Do the New Low Down.
Lenox Avenue is known for doing the low down, but you'll find they're not alone in doing the low down. Fifth Avenue's learning how they had to fall. Fifth Avenue does it now, and that's not all. Whenever the folks high up
lowdown. There ain't no lowdown lower than that. You may believe it or not, but when they start getting hot, there is no a hot and hot top that's hotter than that. So you can lay yon down down when they go low down. There ain't no lowdown lower than that.
Was American music ever considered a bad influence when you were growing up?
Oh, it certainly was. It certainly was at the rather expensive prep school that I was sent to improve me. The vice headmaster of the school, and he was vice in all senses of the word, he had a collection of records, Gilbert and Sullivan and so forth, and he was called Captain. He's dead now, so we can talk about Captain Manning. And he had Gilbert and Sullivan, but he had a little bit of this American stuff, and he had some Sophie Tucker. And he also, which I liked, and the other record, though, that I liked, and it was being played on the BBC at that time, which he didn't like, was Kiss Me Big by Tennessee Ernie Ford. It had these lines, kiss me big, make me know it. When I've been kissed, I want to show it. When our lips meet just under my nose, don't turn me loose till it curls my toes. That's the kind of kissing I've been missing. Baby, won't you kiss me big? Well, the vice headmaster, he didn't mind songs about the American South in the 20s, but he did object to Kiss Me Big. So he said, this was American decadence.
Well, because it had the word kiss in it? No, not because of kiss. Well, it implied sex.
These were pre-rock and roll records, but in all senses and sounds, they were rock and roll. I mean, they were about the same things. They were about sex, and they were set to a syncopated beat.
How did you finally get to go to America, and how old were you the first time you came?
Let me see. I was, I think, 22. It was 1963. I'll never forget that year.
The first hit that you had. Actually, the only hit that made the charts was... Was Nervous on the charts, too?
No, they were all...
No,
Sporting Life, this Sporting Life was on the charts. It reached 99.
Ah. Never,
well, that was the first sort of minor hit.
How did you write You Turn Me On?
Well, what happened was I didn't really write the song. What happened was that in 1964, when I was in America, I was in a couch late at night in Seattle somewhere, and this young girl said, Ian, I love your accent. You're really turning me on. And I thought, what a phrase. You turn on a tap, you turn on other things, you turn on a light, you don't turn somebody on. So I kept the phrase in my mind, went back to Trinity College Dublin and put it into a sort of 12-bar blues thing. Come on now.
What did you have to do to promote the record? Did you do anything? I think promoting novelty records, and that was really a novelty record, is probably different than, say, promoting a ballad or you know.
Terry, I didn't promote it. I tried to stop it. That is absolutely...
You really did? Okay.
That's absolutely true. I tried to stop the record. I thought it was so disgusting. I had a protest song about No Tears for Johnny. It was an anti-war song. This bloody record company, they said, oh, no, man, this is a Stone Fox smash. Don't knock success. I said, but this is going to ruin me culturally. And indeed it has.
Well, once you were no longer on the charts, and it was a pretty short time that you were, is that when you really started seriously turning to Tin Pan Alley?
Well, I'd always liked to muse old songs, and I started researching. By that time, I discovered the real ragtime Scott Joplin, and then I started getting, you know, because I'm really a novelty man, I began to sing the old songs. And so, yes, I found myself washed up in the late 60s, totally irrelevant in this new, brave, new world. And so I went back into the past, and I've stayed there. And I wrote a book, because I couldn't get any other work. It's as simple as that. But now I'm proudest of my books.
You've just completed a book about Irving Berlin. Why did you want to write a book about him?
Well, because I centered in on him as the man who was the beginning and perhaps the end of the sort of pop that I like. I mean, he really did start modern American popular song. There was only one man before him, Stephen Foster. He didn't get organized.
Has living in America given you a different perspective on American Tin Pan Alley?
Yes, I admire it even more. You see, I see this spirit, this American spirit. Sometimes I get misunderstood. Sometimes people here say, how dare you come here, an Englishman, and a failure at that, and tell us about ourselves in such rude terms. But of course, I mean this as a compliment. I love this wonderful Mark Twainian, Mark Twain was the first to talk about this, this mixture of art and commerce, and they are quintessentially American, and Americans are always on the move. They're always and they've got tremendous hope, and they have ideals, and they love making money too, and they have wonderful open hearts too. And it's so, you know, you only have to go to Britain today or the rest of the world to see that this doesn't exist anywhere else. So I've always said, God bless America.
That's a name of a song.
Well, that was Berlin's song, which he wrote, by the way, for his big soldier show, Yip Yip Yap Hank, in World War I. You know, that song was canned from the show in World War I in 1918, because they said, Oiving, you've gone over the top here. I mean, no, that's too much. God bless America. How can you say that? So he put it away. He put it away. And then Kate Smith rediscovered it in the 1930s. And the rest is history.
Well, Ian Whitcomb, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much for putting up with me. Ian, and America. Thank you, America.
Ian, that was fun.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
My interview with Ian Whitcomb was recorded in 1988. He died last month of complications from a stroke. He was 78. After we take a short break, Lloyd Schwartz will review new recordings of music by Bach and Handel. This is Fresh Air.
A rabbi, an Arab, and a comedian, all with COVID-19, walk into a luxury hotel.
There was a Zumba class, old, young, religious, secular, Arab, Jewish. I was like, where am I?
It's the Hotel Corona on NPR's Rough Translation.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, says he's not listening to a lot of classical music during the pandemic, but a couple of recent recordings of works that go back to such great Baroque masters as Bach and Handel have really caught his attention. Here's Lloyd's review.
The news is so heavy these days, I find it hard to listen to music that's too serious. But a couple of recordings of serious music have delighted my ears, and I've been listening to them over and over again. One is a fascinating experiment. Several years ago, I heard Johnny Gandelsman, the wonderful violinist of the Brooklyn Rider String Quartet, play a whole evening devoted to Bach's complete sonatas and partitas for solo violin. At the end of this marathon, Yo-Yo Ma, who was in the audience to hear his friend, shouted out, "Encore!" It got a big laugh. But Gandelsman was unflappable. He picked up his violin and started to play the opening of one of Bach's suites for solo cello, a Yo-Yo Ma specialty. That got an even bigger laugh. Now, Gandelsman has a new recording of his violin transcription of all six Bach suites for solo cello. And on the violin, these famous pieces sound like brand new works. They are lighter, airier. A great cellist like Ma or the legendary Pablo Casals gives these pieces a deep, soulful beauty, as if the cello is singing of grief or mourning, even in the liveliest movements. But on the violin, we can hear even more clearly the way a Baroque suite is actually a set of dances. The violin emphasizes their buoyancy and lilt. Bach composed his sixth and final suite for a cello with five strings instead of the usual four. And Gandelsman here uses a five-string violin, not unheard of to anyone familiar with country music fiddling. I've also been enjoying a new recording by one of my favorite young singers, Metropolitan Opera mezzo-soprano Kate Lindsay. It's a set of three seldom-heard 18th-century cantatas by Handel, Haydn, and Alessandro Scarlatti, all on the lugubrious theme of lost love. The CD is called Arianna, and each of the pieces tells the story of Ariadne, Arianna in Italian. She was the princess from Crete who fell in love with the Greek hero Theseus. She helped him find his way out of the labyrinth after he slew the Minotaur by giving him a ball of thread so that he could retrace his steps through the maze. Theseus took her to the island of Naxos, but abandoned her there. Eventually, the god Dionysus rescued her and turned her into a constellation. In the 20th century, this was the subject of Richard Strauss's famous opera Ariadne auf Naxos. But it was a subject that had already interested composers over 300 years earlier. Handel, like Bach, occasionally recycled his own music. The first aria in the Handel cantata that Kate Lindsay sings on this recording is actually the same music for a Handel aria she sang just this past season at the Met. She played a very kinky young Nero in Handel's viciously satirical opera Agrippina, which was composed around the same time as the cantata. In the opera, Nero's ruthlessly cynical mother, Agrippina, will stop at nothing to make him emperor. In one scene, she's gotten Nero to attract followers by throwing money at them. It's the very same music, down to the memorable introduction, that Handel uses in the cantata as a lament over lost love. Kate Lindsay was as nasty as Nero as she is moving in the cantata.
Thank you.
I'm not quite sure why even the darkest music of this period should be so appealing in these dark times. Maybe the constant forward movement and the relative lightness of the scoring makes time seem to pass more quickly and an end is more clearly in sight. Maybe that's what we need to feel now more than ever.
Lloyd Schwartz writes for WBUR Boston's online journal, The Artery, and is the Poet Laureate of Somerville, Massachusetts. He reviewed new recordings of Johnny Gandelsman playing his violin transcriptions of Bach's complete music for solo cello, and Kate Lindsay singing arias by Handel, Haydn, and Scarlatti on a CD called Ariana. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We end today's show on a sad, happy note. Sad because our associate producer, Muj Zaidi, is leaving our show. But happy for him because he's moving to a great position as a producer of the Vox podcast, Today Explained. I'll miss his creativity, his passion for audio, video, and film, and his production skills in all of the above. And I'll miss talking with him about radio and podcasts and movies. He's tipped me off to some great stuff to watch and listen to. At the end of Monday's show, on the day of Fresh Air's 33rd anniversary as a daily national program, I talked about how frustrating it is for all of us who have something like an anniversary that we should be celebrating together as a group, instead to have to celebrate quietly in isolation or semi-isolation. Now Fresh Air has to say goodbye to Muj without throwing him a goodbye party, you know, with all of us in the same room. But we still will be celebrating with him online. So Muj, see you soon on my computer. We wish you all good things in your new position, and we wish you good health.